You are listening to Sparking Wholeness with Erin Carey, where we talk about all things related to nutrition for mind, body, and soul. Are you ready? Let's do this. Hey, everybody, it's Erin Carey. Welcome back to Sparking Wholeness. Today, I'm sitting down with Dr. Afton Hassett. She's a licensed clinical psychologist who is an associate professor and the director of pain and opioid research in the Department of Anesthesiology at the University of Michigan. As a principal investigator at the renowned Chronic Pain and Fatigue Research Center at UM, she conducts interdisciplinary research related to exploring the role of cognitive, affective, and behavioral factors in chronic pain. She has published over 100 peer-reviewed articles. That is not a typo, truly over 100 peer-reviewed articles, and is a leader in the field of resilience and pain. Her work is focused on exploring the role of positive emotions in people with pain, as well as novel interventions to promote resilience and better pain self-management. She is the author of Chronic Pain Reset, 30 Days of Activities, Practices, and Skills to Help You Thrive, an innovative pain self-management book for patients and their clinicians released earlier this fall. So Dr. Hassett, welcome to the show. Thanks for being on.
Hi, Erin. I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, this is going to be such a fascinating conversation. I can't believe I've never devoted an entire podcast episode to the topic of pain because so many people are suffering from chronic pain. I mean, what is the research showing on chronic pain and how many people are affected?
Yeah, so it really is almost at epidemic proportions, and it feels like it was exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. I think there were a lot of stressors and denial of activities and friendships that I think, you know, send people into some pretty significant chronic pain and mental health spirals. So, you know, to date, our best guess is about 50 million Americans suffer with chronic pain, and a large subset of them have really life debilitating chronic pain. And it affects not just the person who has it, but it really is a very familial, you know, it affects everybody in the family, it affects relationships, it affects people in the workplace. And so I hardly can run into somebody who doesn't know somebody who has chronic pain if they don't have it themselves. So it's a huge problem. I'm so glad you're focusing on it now.
Yeah, I'm glad too. I'll tell you, I have a very low pain tolerance myself. And so anytime I even have a twinge of like, I'm a little bit sore from working out, or maybe I have a little bit of a headache before I start my period, whatever it is, I'm like, oh, this is terrible. And I truly do often think about people that I know with chronic pain and go, how do they deal with this on an ongoing basis? It's got to be debilitating.
Oh, I'm the same way. I'm a great big baby. I have an injury or something. It's like, it destroys my day. I can't think right. I don't function well. I'm cranky. And, you know, again, it's just the appreciation that I've grown to have for people who live like this day in, day out. But what's so remarkable, Erin, the thing I love to study is the people who have chronic pain, but have really amazing lives despite the pain. And so I'm very much a resilience researcher. I love to understand what goes wrong in individuals and how we can fix it, but I'm so fascinated in what's kind of naturally right. Why are people resilient and how can we potentially kind of bottle that and pass it around?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Because I do know that there are many people thriving in spite of these factors, just like there are people thriving with autoimmune disease and depression, anxiety, and a lot of these things intersect as well. So let's talk about the mental health intersection with chronic pain and how those play a role together.
Yeah, it's a hot topic. So kind of our history is that for many years, decades, hundreds of years, perhaps even, people with chronic pain, it was just presumed they have, this is just a manifestation of their mental illness. They, you know, they clearly have depression and anxiety. That's just what it is. So we really don't need to think about a biological explanation. Well, since we've learned that, you know, mental health issues are very biological, this is chronic pain and it's different. And so we do think about depression and anxiety and mood disorders as kind of one thing that has a unique brain networks, but also chronic pain, who has a somewhat different brain network, but they do interface. They interface in the brain, and they also interface in our lives. So people who have chronic pain tend to develop depression and anxiety, often in response to living with chronic pain. And vice versa, people with depression and anxiety are very prone to developing chronic pain. Again, there appears to be kind of this neurobiological substrate, kind of the same chemicals and processes and brain areas that process depression and anxiety, also depression, also process pain in addition. And so, you know, there is this interconnectivity and even potentially some genetic correlates.
That's fascinating to me because, I mean, I even think about, as you know, I've suffered from depression in the past, and it does feel like it's a whole body, and I wouldn't say pain for me, but it's a whole body, can't get out of bed, can't move, feeling weighed down. And so I can imagine that that can also manifest in pain too. That's interesting. And it's the same, you said it's the same area of the brain. Is that correct?
Well, overlapping areas of the
Overlapping.
brain, as well as many of the same neurotransmitters that are deficits or, you know, they're problematic in pain and depression, anxiety, are also the very same neurotransmitters we need for pain suppression or operate to make the pain worse.
Oh, so you're talking about like GABA? Would GABA be one of
Yes.
those?
Yeah. So yeah, we think, yep. So GABA, serotonin, norepinephrine, they're all involved.
Absolutely, because we use a lot of medications to inhibit the reuptake of things like norepinephrine and serotonin for anxiety and depression. But I know often it's given to people with something like fibromyalgia as well for the same reason.
Yes, very much so. And so it's not the serotonin only targeting drugs. It's really kind of serotonin or norepinephrine drugs that seem to work very well in chronic pain. And so, you know, those are the FDA, some of the FDA drugs that are approved for fibromyalgia because it hits both of those systems.
And how would you say stress and burnout, which is another epidemic we have, how do those play a role in these chronic pain issues?
You know, so I think stress is one of the most important factors in kind of human illness. And, you know, our bodies pay a price for the stress that we experience. And there's a wonderful mentor of mine, Bruce McEwen, who wrote about stress. He was a cell biologist who was very interested in understanding how it is that stress is translated into biological changes. And he wrote about different types of stress. There's kind of a normal good stress that we kind of go through when we're just kind of living our day and nothing terrible happens, but we need to get stuff done. We can be kind of stressed out because we're planning a wedding or some big event. And after the event happens, there's a lot of joy. And so that's kind of this good, normal stress that takes place. But then there's also another type of stress when something very bad happens. And it is bad stress, but if we have the resources to deal with it, then it's considered tolerable, right? So even though you may lose somebody in your life or some, you know, there's a job loss or something terrible that happens, you have the people, the coping abilities, the general physical and mental health to be able to ride that through. So that's kind of tolerable stress. The stress that wipes us out is toxic stress. It's the stress that is maybe just a million little bits every single day, or it's the big thing that happens that we don't have the resources to recover from. And it's toxic stress that tends to play the worst havoc on our bodies. And so we do see that in many cases with people with chronic pain, they have come from environments and experiences of toxic stress, be it a terrible work environment or adverse childhood experiences or, you know, terrible relationships or a victim of a crime. I mean, there's many, many things that can create this toxic stress. And we often see that then stress kind of pulls the trigger. And when I say pulls the trigger, it means very often people are kind of genetically predisposed to potentially developing chronic pain, just like people are genetically predisposed to developing diabetes or cancer. And then something happens in the environment that triggers a process. So that's one thing that stress does. And then certainly we know that stress makes symptoms worse. So people who do have chronic pain, when they're under stress, they will tell you it's so much worse. And then the third thing that happens when we're stressed is we don't take good care of ourselves. As soon as we're feeling kind of persistently stressed, we stop exercising, we stop meditating, we eat poorly, we sometimes disconnect from our friendships. And so those all kind of drive both our mental health, but also, you know, the mechanisms that pretty much underlie chronic pain. So that's kind of how stress fits in on many levels.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You know, it makes me even think just as a personal story, a few weeks ago, I was struggling with some lower back pain. And I'm like, what is going on with my body right now? I'm like, I didn't really, haven't been working out too hard. My lower back just feels twingy, is what I call it. And I remembered that it had been 9 years since my dad had suffered almost a life-threatening heart attack. My grandma that I was really close to had passed away 13 years previous to that. And then I had a friend who was going through a really difficult emotional time. And I thought it was really interesting that the reminder, you know, even those subtle reminders from my body of the past trauma, plus the current overwhelm, impacted my lower back. So
yes,
that's fascinating that our body can pick up on what our brain is sending it, right?
And that is just, that's so on the mark. And it's really that observation is probably something many people have always kind of known, but it's really something that we're just really accepting in science, that there are, the brain experiences threat in many ways, right? So something that may not truly be threatening, the brain might feel as threat. So your thoughts and your memories about loss and about kind of sadness and, you know, and longing, that to some degree can be perceived as threat in the brain. And when that happens, pain often is activated.
Yeah.
So, you know, there really is kind of these processes that we understand. And there's entire chronic pain conditions that are somewhat fueled by the brain just overreacting to signals and to stress.
That's interesting. And even as you mentioned, you know, genes load the gun, environment pulls the trigger, stress pulls the trigger, basically what you were saying. My mom and my sister and I, we all experience pain in the same areas,
really?
Like in our hips and in our lower back. Isn't that interesting? And so when we do have, especially flare-ups of stress, emotional stress. And so I thought, as you're saying this, I'm just connecting the dots. And I think listeners probably are too, wondering, okay, where are things showing up for me? This is really, really fascinating, but we can become more resilient.
Yes. And we can. And I think we, you know, if we, the more we understand kind of our stress and pain patterns, because I kind of think almost everybody has a little bit of that. At least, you know, there's some sort of biological response. Some people, their stomachs get all out of whack. Other people get headaches. You know, there's, you know, other people's sleep becomes incredibly disturbed. You know, there are just kind of bodily reactions to the stress that we feel. And the more that we can identify, know what those are. So, for example, when I get really stressed, my shoulders kill me. And I just like, okay, I know what I'm doing. And part of it is what I'm doing behaviorally. I'm probably tensing my muscles. Sleeping well, I'm probably not sitting properly, but it is often just kind of the manifestation of stress. And the more that we kind of understand these signals, the better caretakers we can be of our bodies and our brains. And say, you know, the next time you experience pain in your hips or back, you might say, oh, okay, maybe I'm overdoing it, or maybe, you know, maybe there's something I need to pay attention to in this my world that's causing some distress in my life.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that historically speaking, I know a lot of us grew up going, oh, I'm hurting, I need to take an ibuprofen or whatever, right? But you're saying, look inward and grow more self-awareness and get curious and go, okay, what is going on right now for me? What's happening in my world? I think that is also very self-compassionate instead of just shoving aside. Nothing, you know, nothing wrong with people that do, you know, choose to take anti-inflammatories or whatever it is, right? Like not knocking those, those are an option. But tell me about what a holistic and interdisciplinary approach to the treatment of chronic pain would look like.
So I think it's the best treatment that we have, really approaching people with medical illnesses from multiple angles, right? So, and especially in chronic pain, because it is a chronic condition, you know, by its definition, it's pain that's lasted more than 3 months. It's not just kind of the twinge that passes and comes and goes. Yeah. It's really something that has kind of taken on a life of its own. It's now really quite disruptive. And so, as such, often there's other things that change in our lives, right? We probably stop exercising some, our sleep often becomes disturbed. We may have some disruptions at work, we may have disruptions in the family. So there's all of these kind of things, all these domains are affected. And so having an approach where potentially a physician comes in first and does the diagnosis and identifies, you know, what is kind of causing the pain? You know, is it an inflammatory condition like an autoimmune disease? Is it an injury that you have done and that we might need to do something about with physical therapy? or is it a chronic pain condition like fibromyalgia or chronic low back pain that may be less about the injured area and more about the brain now processing pain in a very different way? And once that determination is made to the best of the ability, he or she, the physician, can now maybe recommend a medication or two, ideally not a monstrous cocktail, but maybe one or two things that can be helpful. Next thing I love to see, almost everybody can benefit from seeing a physical therapist, or if you're really deconditioned, an occupational therapist, somebody to help you get moving again and walking and exercising and rebuild some of the muscle that's often lost. And then we hope that somebody will see a behaviorist, somebody that can help you better self-manage your pain. And that doesn't mean that they think you have mental illness. They often think that, you could probably develop some great skills to help you better manage your pain. But in the cases where people do have depression and anxiety along with their chronic pain, they too can benefit from also seeing a behavioral psychologist or somebody who can help them, work with the depression and anxiety that comes alongside. So it's really this team that kind of needs to come in and really help and do an assessment. What we don't do is that often enough. Too frequently, people just get to see a physician very briefly. A medication is given, very little. There's almost no time for education. And what we know about chronic pain now, the neuroscience of chronic pain is so rich and so fascinating, but nobody in the context of clinical care has 45 minutes to sit down with you and walk you through it and help build the rationale. And so that's kind of the impetus of my book is that, how can we not only help patients themselves, but help care providers provide good, comprehensive care? And one of the things is to give this wide and rich education about pain and how pain is in the brain and what is the role of stress and how do emotions overlap? How do our thoughts overlap? How does trauma play in? And I think when people read that and think, oh my gosh, I get it now. Mm-hmm. I understand now why I should be exercising, or it makes so much more sense why when I'm depressed, things are worse. And so that's just incredibly empowering. So coming at it from a wide angle and really rich in education.
Yes. I love the opportunity for light bulb moments like that for people to when they connect the dots. I know for me, I had, it was close to 10 years ago when I had a light bulb moment with my mental health and realizing, the gut brain connection and how food plays a role and all those things. And that was life-changing for me. And so let's talk about enhancing positive emotions and why that's important for people with chronic pain, because it's mentioned here in the notes that I have that you can discuss dysregulation in the reward processing system. I want to know about that. And let's talk about that.
Oh, fine. I'm going to geek out in neuroscience here, but so when happy things happen in our life, positive things happen in our life, the way they're experienced is first through the brain. And there is circuitry in our brain. It's what we call the reward processing system, simply meaning reward, just meaning good stuff. So when good stuff happens, we get a hug from somebody we love, or we win something, or, there's a beautiful sunset. There's a part of our brain that activates and it releases dopamine and we feel, we feel this great feeling and it's reinforced. And we really have taken in that positive thing. And by having that reinforcing experience, we seek more. So we want to have that experience and we will go out there and we'll try and get, recreate the experience and see people go to beautiful places, enjoy great food. What happens in many conditions, including depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, substance use disorder, and chronic pain, is that part of the brain kind of becomes dysregulated. And what happens is great things, positive things fail to register as that. And so it really kind of helps explain when people have chronic pain or depression that they often just kind of feel, meh. something great will happen. It's like, whatever, right? Because that part of the brain is not working. And what's lovely though is there's been a number of studies that show that we can fix that. Especially in substance use disorders where the substance itself has dysregulated that area, that over time the system repairs itself. And with a little bit of training, again, it repairs itself. And so one of the ways to help do that is to purposefully go out and seek positive stuff. And so we try and teach people with chronic pain that It's good to go out and do acts of kindness. It's wonderful to keep a gratitude journal. It's really important to go out there and do things you enjoy. Please get back to your hobbies. Spend time with people that bring you joy or make you feel loved and supported. All of those things slowly re-expose the circuitry and get things functioning again. And it kind of stacks up. So the more that these pleasant things kind of lay the foundation, the easier it is to start reacting to these positive things again. So we can reverse some of that. And that's why it's such a central element of our treatment to, you know, to also teach skills in savoring and gratitude and positive activity.
Wow. Okay. So my brain is going now. Because I like to know why about everything.
Yeah.
Like, since I was a little kid, like, I just want to know why. Why does that happen? Yeah. Why does it happen? And I'm thinking about, you know, a lot of times people who have this dysregulation would often turn to things like ultra processed foods and sugar,
yeah.
right? Sugar sweetened beverages. But we know, I mean, I just read the best meta-analysis recently, review in the BMJ, talking about ultra processed foods and how it's now linked to 32 negative health outcomes. And part of the reason is because that hyper palatability, of course, it kind of sparks our brain, right?
Yep.
In a good
mm-hmm.
way. And we're like, ooh, positive
yeah.
reinforcement.
Yeah.
But it keeps us hungry and keeps us
yeah.
wanting more, but not necessarily in a positive way. So it's
right.
almost like a false dopamine, maybe.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. Yeah.
But
yeah.
these things you're saying, like experiences and gratitude
yeah.
and acts of kindness, those are authentic dopamine rewards.
Exactly. It's, you know, it's so funny, you know, it's not exactly a great map on, but in the kind of the field of positive psychology, we talk about hedonic happiness and eudaimonic happiness.
Okay.
Yeah, right? And hedonic happiness is great happiness. It's fun. It's shopping. It's partying. It's running about.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, having joyful things happen. Whereas eudaimonic happiness is kind of slower and richer. It's gratitude. It's love. It's relationships. It's bonding with our, you know, with our children
Yeah.
and our pets. I mean, it's these other things. And so we want more of that kind of eudaimonic happiness, that, you know, that really rich, subtle, rather than that quick, delicious, very
Yeah.
fatty, overprocessed food.
Yeah, I call it a quick hit. So you're right. Yeah, it's like the quick hit of sugar.
It's
is,
like a drug.
But then it is.
Yeah.
Well, and even, I mean, you know, think about the queso morphins and the gluteomorphins and dairy and gluten and how that impacts the brain and the reward centers. I mean, there's just so much to that. But you're talking about, something that's going to stick and it's going to last longer. Yeah, I love that. Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about your book and just kind of the layout of it, and it is interactive. And what sets your book apart for people with chronic pain?
Well, thank you for asking that. So there's some really good books out there. I'm so impressed by some of my fellow academics who have kind of taken the same steps and said, you know, we need to get this into people's hands. What I do that's a little bit differently, because I come from the resilience world, I kind of think in those terms and really wanting to kind of reactivate the reward processing areas of the brain and get people moving again. And so I really kind of focus on things that are really engaging and rewarding. And so the way that the book kind of sets up, you know, as I was mentioning before, is really the first, I think it's 15 chapters are just really short chapters, but they boil down the neuroscience of chronic pain, of emotions, of stress, but they do so hopefully in a fun way with a lot of storytelling. And I have a lot of patients that share their stories that are just so inspirational and lovely. And, you know, and that those first sets of chapters kind of set the tone for why doing the things that they will do in this next section might work. And really, the argument is that we know that chronic pain appears to be caused by the by changes in the structure and the function of the brain. But our science of neuroplasticity says that the brain is malleable and can be changed. And there's many things that we can do through diet and exercise. So movement, sleep, all of that can change the structure and the function of the brain. But so can many things that we do. And so part two of the book is kind of what I call like a little 30-day challenge. And what I do is over a 2-page spread is I introduce a different activity, skill, and practice every day. And so the reader is challenged to every day pop open the book and read about the activity, skill, or practice, and then try it for that day. So it could be mindful breathing for that day. It could be keeping a gratitude journal. It could be learning time-based pacing so that when you have chronic pain, you don't overdo in a day. It can be considering your relationships. It can be exercise, doing a nature walk. I mean, there's all these different things to try. And each day the person tries it just for that day and does not expect anything to change, really, because, you know, it takes a lot more than one dose of this thing. But to say, you know what, I like this. This is actually something I think I could do on a longer term basis. And to do each of these after 30 days and then identify maybe five or six that feel like real keepers. This is something that makes sense to me, given my pain. I can work into my life that I'm actually excited to do. This actually sounds fun. And then we build what we call a thriving plan. So where you kind of try each of these on a little longer term basis for weeks. Often you want somebody to try something for weeks to see if it really works and not also to see if it becomes a habit. And that's really kind of it. It's really how to build a plan that's really personalized for you and that makes sense. And that very much comes from our understanding as, you know, as providers of care, that the thing that people will do when they come to the doctor's office is the thing that makes sense to them and that they're willing to do and that feels like something that is valuable. And so this allows people to kind of make those decisions themselves.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. And it sounds like it's very interactive and it is based on, I mean, all of the latest research that we have, which know you're a big proponent of and that you're actively involved with as well. Now, what about for people who struggle with, and I know this is probably a lot of people struggle with the motivation, like who just kind of feel like I've tried everything and this is just how it's going to be. And I guess there's no hope for me. What would you say to encourage them?
Yeah. And it's so common. And I just feel for people with chronic pain because they really have, in the first place, it probably took them years to get a diagnosis.
Absolutely.
And everybody trying all different things and sometimes 10 things at once. And it's just, you know, it doesn't feel like the thing is out there for them. So what I say here is, you know what? What do you have to lose? Suspend doubt for a little bit and give something different a try, because this is something that you can control. This is not the doctor saying you do that or you do this. This is you learning about different things that you get to pick that feel like they might be helpful to you. And I've heard from patients to say, oh my gosh, I just did one thing. This one thing has radically changed my ability to function, or this one thing has helped me reconnect with, you know, what really, really matters to me. And now, yes, I still have pain, but oh my goodness, my life is in a different trajectory and I have less pain because I'm sleeping better, I'm more active. So, you know, sometimes that one thing will resonate. So again, one thing I hope my book provides is hope.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that idea that it could just be one thing that you haven't tried. Mm-hmm. There could just be one thing, or maybe a couple small things.
Yeah.
And reading this going, oh, yeah. And targeting back or going back to the topic of sleep, I know that can be just instrumental, right? I mean, that is, or foundational for chronic pain, for anything really. But can you talk a little bit about some strategies to support sleep when you're dealing with chronic pain?
Oh yeah, that's so important. I mean, so many of us suffer from insomnia, situational insomnia. I even had it at one point, and that's when you really appreciate how disruptive it can be in your life. So poor sleep is pretty much an epidemic too. But as it pertains to chronic pain, most of these skills kind of pertain to everybody. But the first thing we recommend is for people just to do sleep time stabilization. This is the easiest thing we can do, but the hardest. So what this just means is go to bed at the same time every night and get up at the same time every morning within half an hour, if possible, even on weekends. So it's hard to do, but your body loves predictability. It runs on cycles and rhythms, and predictability is key. And so just in stabilizing sleep, you know, and maybe even just over a 2-week period, we see radical changes in what people experience and how much better their sleep can be. Other people really benefit from light therapy or just getting light exposure. Getting up first thing in the morning and getting out on the porch or sitting in front of a bright light or getting out right by the window for half an hour or an hour. If you can, do what you can just to have that light exposure. Just again, that's resetting areas of your brain that that really help keep time to help us do that. And then there are millions of things that we do to disrupt sleep that are just, once you recognize what it is, you think, oh my gosh, it's so silly. And so, you know, sleeping with disruptive pets, as much as we love our pets, sometimes they wake us up every 45 minutes. And while you think, oh, it's fine, you really are disrupting the sleep cycle, you know, every time that you wake up, right? So sleeping with a disruptive bed partner who is a big snorer or whatever the case is, you know, that we need to think about, you know, how can we get around that so we can get our sleep? It could be earplugs, it could be separate bedrooms, it could be what, you know, what we have to make decisions about how best to preserve our health. A big one, and this one has changed my life, is light, getting rid of the light, getting light dampening or light, I can't remember what you call it, but the curtains that totally filter light out like they have in hotel rooms. So powerful. There was a really lovely study conducted a few years ago that had people sleep in rooms that had totally dark light, you know, had the light totally blanked out or just light in. And they found that the people who were exposed to light while they're sleeping, even though they slept well and didn't detect light, actually had more inflammation in their bodies because that part of the body cycle wasn't working properly because it was still responding to the light, even through the eyelids. So blanking out light, not exercising too close to bed, having a really good habit before you go to sleep. Just these are the five wind down things I do, getting close to bed and do them religiously as a habit. So, you know, it's brush my teeth, it's put on my jammies, it's, you know, it's do my meditation, it's stretch or whatever it is, and then go to bed. And then lastly, no screens. If we can avoid screens an hour or two before bed, that's really important. So those are my favorite tips.
I love that. And I think for the parents listening to this who have young children, this is so important. I mean, I do know a lot of parents work hard, especially when their babies or their kids are babies or toddlers, to establish nighttime routines, bedtime routines for them. But we need to remember to do that for ourselves too. That's a huge missing piece. And like, I know for one of my kids, his brain settles down when I read to him before bed. I don't know if it's just, you know, my voice being calming for him or the words or whatever it is, but I mean, that's a huge puzzle piece for winding his little brain down. And so I'm wondering for adults, I mean, maybe that's a missing piece, reading instead of Netflix, instead of, you know, the really scary show you're watching, or intense show you're watching, right? So, yes. I mean, I think that's treating yourself like you would your child, I think is huge for parents.
And we totally forget, right? You know, it's the routine. It's that the peaceful time. It's also kind of a bonding time too. And then it just kind of deactivates all that sympathetic nervous system from the day running around. It's just deactivated. It's that feeling of love and calm and, you know, social connection.
Yeah. Yeah. And oxytocin, right? Oxytocin. The touch. Yeah. That's a fun one. We could nerd out about that one on a whole different episode, but tell me a little bit before we go, something really stuck out to me about one of the things that you're researching right now. I'm fascinated by this, developing a prehabilitation program for anxious surgical patients to optimize outcomes. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is my pet project.
Okay.
So I'm in the Department of Anesthesiology. Anesthesiologists kind of do two things. They put people to sleep. They also do pain medicine. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of blended my two loves. I was working with some just really remarkable surgeons who have been with us in studying how anxiety predicts poor surgical outcomes, especially chronic pain. And so we put our heads together and said, you know what? Anxiety is this incredible predictor of poor surgical outcomes, everything from hospital stays on and on into complications. What if we reduced anxiety before? And we're not the first people to think about this. You know, it's been done. It's important in that kind of that early couple of weeks, you know, especially with elective surgeries, we know a couple of weeks in advance. And so we can share with patients things they can do. And so one thing that we did is we developed this, we have a little beta series app that we use that has these beautiful recordings, these just guided imageries. There's breathing retraining. working. There is specific suggestion about healing and pain management. And they're just these lovely, lovely recordings. And we send them to patients in advance of their surgery, and they get them regularly. And there's also a series of educational videos that just talks about surgery to set the context. And it just says, you know, surgery is painful and a little pain is good. We don't want you leaping out of bed and ripping your incisions. You know, that's okay. You'll be all right with that. And that, you know, and that, you know, and then we talk about, you know, the benefits of opioids and the concerns about opioids and proper disposal, on and on. And what we found in just kind of doing this little prehabilitation is not only could we, or did we see reduced pain, but we saw reduced opioid use, like radically reduced at 2 weeks after surgery. It was like people thought, oh, okay, well, I've got these other things I can do. I can breathe. A little pain is okay. I should probably should feel a little pain so I don't hurt my sutures. And you know, it just really changed the frame. So again, it's the power of education, of just the empowerment of educating people so they understand their pain, their brain, and you know, their ability to heal. That's why I love what you do. The more we educate, the better. And then, you know, then just giving people the tools.
Oh, I am so fascinated. So it's almost like you're reversing the nocebo effect, right? In surgery. Because for me, I'm a person, and this just comes from early life medical trauma that was life-saving medical intervention. Yeah. But for me, of course, was translated as trauma in a young brain. Yeah. And I'm terrified of any medical interventions. I'm terrified of having surgery. Giving birth for me, I did receive epidurals, but oh, I had panic attacks with my third child because I had a bad experience with an epidural with my second child. So I just have a lot of negative connotations with getting surgery in the hospital. I don't respond well to anesthesia. So for somebody like me, if something happens and I have to go in for something that I need, I mean, something like this would be a huge benefit because I know I'll already be freaking myself out before I get there. Yeah, that's incredible.
Thank you. You know, Erin, you're not alone. You know, surgical anxiety is really high. Almost nobody undergoing surgery is like, hey, no big deal.
Right.
People feel it, but some people who have had medical trauma or other things, it is profoundly impactful. And to have some tools so you don't feel that you're going in, let me know. I'll make sure to get you something.
Right? No, I think that's so important. I think it's important for people to hear that too, that the anxiety is normal, but then we can also improve our outcomes by managing the anxiety and acknowledging it and being like, this is a scary situation. I think too many people are just like, no, it's not scary. I'm just going to do it. And then we push down the anxiety and it makes it worse.
Yes, exactly right. That, you know, our emotions are there to tell us things. They're really important. They don't run us, ideally. And sometimes they just are. But just being aware that they exist and think, oh, that's so interesting. I'm having some fear. This is probably what it's about. And I can help quell that because I understand what it's about. I'm afraid of this surgery because I had some trauma.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. That is fascinating. I've just enjoyed this entire episode, but I have to ask you my favorite question. The last thing I ask, the name of the show is Sparking Wholeness. So if you could give one piece of advice to spark someone toward wholeness, what would it be?
Oh my gosh. It would be take the time to do something that makes your life feel rich and rewarding, right? So it can be 10 minutes of mindfulness. It could be 10 minutes of stretching. It could be 10 minutes of hugging your cat. Whatever it is that just makes you feel alive and rewarded and happy, make the time to do that. If we've often squeezed that out, the things that make our lives the most beneficial, especially people with chronic pain, they put aside the really valued life activities all in favor of doing things that we must do or feel like we must do instead of the things that make life worth living. And that's, I think, how we find ourselves often feeling depressed, stressed, and burnout because we don't prioritize the pleasant activities.
And is it true that women are more likely to suffer from chronic pain than men?
That's true. Yes, that is true.
I'm wondering if that is, I mean, historically speaking, not to generalize, you know, genders and things, but women, historically speaking, have taken on more than even as emotional burdens and served at the expense of their own health. So that's really interesting.
It's a girl thing. Yes, we do.
And the fawn response doesn't help either,
What's
right?
that?
The fawn response doesn't help
Oh
either.
yeah, exactly. So yeah, we need to be aware of that. And also there are probably some pretty powerful neurobiological elements as well, but certainly there are very important cultural aspects and gender and sex, aspects too.
Wow. Okay. This has been so fascinating. Now, tell everybody where they can find more information about your book, purchase your book, and even follow you on social media to know more about what you're doing.
Oh, thanks, Erin. So it's at Afton Hassett, AFTONHASSETT. I'm on Instagram and X, and I have a website, aftonhassett.com. You can purchase the book there. It's also on Amazon. If you enjoy it, please leave a review. Some of the most fascinating reviews are from people who have chronic pain who think, oh, I didn't think a book could be helpful. So I'd love to hear from you. Please feel free to reach out to me directly too. I'm easy to find.
Awesome. Well, this has been so insightful. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show.
Thank you, Erin. It was a lot of fun.
The tiniest spark leads to the biggest blaze, and I hope that today's episode sparks you on a journey to healing and wholeness. Thanks for listening to Sparking Wholeness. For more information on what I do and my coaching programs, or maybe just to reach out and say hey, find me at sparkingwholeness.com or on Instagram at sparkingwholeness. Have a fabulous week.